Hello, listeners. Welcome to another episode of The Cozy Corner with Alexia Gordon. Join me, your host, Alexia Gordon, as I chat with authors writing cozy, traditional, and historical mysteries. You won't find explicit sex or graphic violence. You will find intriguing authors and quality fiction. Thanks for listening. Welcome, listeners, to another episode of The Cozy Corner with Alexia Gordon. I'm Alexia Gordon, author and host of the podcast. Author Iona Wishaw joins me in the corner today to chat about her new novel, To Track a Traitor, a Lane Winslow mystery. Welcome, Iona.
Hi, I'm happy to be here.
Well, I'm happy to have you. Now, To Track a Traitor is your 10th Lane Winslow mystery. Please introduce us to Lane and tell us what she's up to this time out.
Well, Lane Winslow is a retired British spy, really. She worked for intelligence during the war, and she's moved off to Canada. And during the course of the first 10 books, she has various adventures. And one of them is marrying the local inspector of police in Nelson. And in this particular case, Lane has received a phone call from England, from Scotland, where her grandparents live. And they've said that her sister came to visit, but she's disappeared. So Lane is going to have to go to Scotland to find out what's happened to her annoying sister.
That sounds exciting. And I hope her sister's not so annoying that she doesn't want to find her.
Well, you know, she complains all the way through about the sister, but they haven't seen each other in 10 years because the sister went off to South Africa at the beginning of the war, and Lane stayed in England and worked in Europe. So she hasn't seen her sister for 10 years. She knows nothing about her life. So she's going to get quite a big surprise.
Wow. Now, your mysteries have been compared to Louise Penny, Jacqueline Winspear, and Carrie Greenwood. So who are some of your influences?
Well, some of my favorite mystery writers are some old classics, like I love Dorothy L. Sayers, for example. Geez, you know, I read so many mystery books, and I love so many. I mean, I love things from Longmire to Agatha Christie, to lots of new writers that are out there. So it's very hard to say what my main influences would be. But I should also add a childhood influence, Nancy Drew.
Ah, yes. So many of us, Nancy Drew was our gateway drug into
a gateway drug, exactly. Scene.
I'm not surprised in a way that you are a fan of the Golden Age mystery classics, because your novel is set in the 1940s, and parts are also set in 1917. So what's it like writing a story that goes back and forth between two different historical time periods?
I really enjoy it. What I try to do is, you know, when I've got a character, I want my readers to understand a little bit about the character. And one of the ways that you can do that, rather than just say, explaining about something that might have happened in the past, you know, she had done this, she had done that. Instead of that, I go right into a previous period. So let's say 1917, where you're suddenly in that person's life and you're seeing something that happened to them. And as a reader, then you go, okay, well, that was interesting. I wonder why that's important. And you kind of carry it through in your following of the story, because it's a kind of clue, really. And I just enjoy dropping into scenes, you know, as if I'd walked suddenly into someone's house and seen them at their lives, you know. It's just something I really enjoy. I mean, and I really enjoy history. So it's the other thing is it's like putting myself in that situation for a spell.
And that actually leads into my next question. I mean, do you get so immersed in the historical time period that you're writing about that that you kind of forget you're in the 21st century writing about the past?
I think yes, I'm going to. I haven't been asked that question before, Alexia. Very good. I think yes. I think I do. And that's actually important for my books because, you know, one of the problems about writing something that's taking place in a historical context before our technological time is that you don't have all the recourses of the modern world to help you. So as long as I'm in that historical frame of mind, it's easier for me to find solutions that aren't, oh my gosh, where's my cell phone, which nobody had before, you know, 1990 or whatever it is. So I think I do get lost there. And I want to, because I want people to feel the details in the same way that I do.
And I'm laughing a little bit because my little, you know, snafu getting this interview started on my cell phone. I kind of miss a hardwired landline where it would have been easy just to pick it up and call you.
Exactly.
when you get so immersed in the historical time period and create a novel that is, you know, truly feels like you were back then, how do you keep that relatable to modern readers? You know, one criticism some people have of some historical novels is, you know, it's kind of the historical part sort of window dressing, but they're really modern people kind of play acting it being back when. So how do you kind of keep it relatable to the modern readers, especially given that you do get so immersed in the historical setting?
Well, I think there's a couple of ways. I think one of the things that people may find slightly exhausting about some historical anythings, any kind of historical novel, is there's so many details, you know, where the author is trying so hard to introduce so many, and I just talked about details in my previous remarks, but you know, there's the naming of all kinds of different things and all kinds of historical details and maybe political or whatever the details are. And I think what happens for a lot of readers is their eyes just kind of glaze over, you know, and they it's just too much. So what I try very hard to do is to make sure that if I do have some historical reference, like something that happened historically, that I only give enough details that are relevant to the story I'm writing, rather than try to overwhelm the reader with all these details about a historical event. So I only, you know, I use it very, very sparingly. So you're never pulled away from what's happening to the characters. So that's one of the techniques I use. And then the other thing I use is I try very hard to preserve the language of the period so that people aren't pulled away from it. I think one of the things that I find difficult when I'm reading a historical novel is if someone uses a very modern expression, and I'm right away snapped away from my sense of the period I'm reading about. So I'd say those are two things I try to do.
Now, I'm going to make the assumption that when you're doing your research, I mean, you have a lot more facts than you include in your stories. But when you're researching these time periods, have you noticed differences? Well, I should take that back. Obviously, there are differences between 1917 and the 1940s, but have you noticed any similarities between the two? I mean, those were the two major world wars, which were, you know, just as, you know, earth-shattering to the world at the time as, you know, recent events have been to us. I mean, have you noticed any similarities between them, despite the fact that they're, you know, separated by so many years?
Well, I think the similarities are always going to be about people. You know, people respond to stresses, you know, historically in much the same way, because we're constructed a certain way. You know, we respond to fear, to violence, to love, to all of these kinds of emotions in much the same way. So in that sense, you have that. I think a big difference between the First War and the Second War is that the First War was really the beginning of the, you know, mass death, technological type of war. And by the Second World War, you had all that technology, but I think people weren't as surprised by it and had learned different ways to fight with it. So, you know, those are the, I mean, wars are hardly cozy, but those are the differences, I think. And, you know, I mean, I don't feel like any society has ever really been prepared for what happens when their soldiers come home, as you know, just from modern times, how difficult it is to reintegrate warriors into society. So, and that's another, I think, real similarity.
I mean, your research sounds fascinating. It also sounds like from reading your book jacket, like some of your research was in your own family's wartime archives. You care to tell us about that a little?
I can tell you a little, for sure. One of the things is that my character, Lane Winslow, was actually originally inspired by my mother, who as a young woman had been drop dead gorgeous, could speak 7 languages almost perfectly, and you know, who grew up in a very internationalist community, just like my character Lane Winslow. And one of the things I learned about her late in life is that when she and my father were living in South Africa prior to the war, she actually got engaged in intelligence gathering for the British, in which she would sort of pass herself off as a German girl because she spoke absolutely flawless German, and would go to German officers' clubs and dues and so on to try to get information for the British. So that was the kind of work she did. And she probably continued it into the war when South Africa entered the war against Germany. You know, it was an interesting place, South Africa, because you had a whole population of people who actually supported the Germans. And then it turns out that her father, my grandfather, was a longtime spy. He was a businessman, but he also was a spy. For both world wars, he worked for MI6. And I just learned recently that he had 2 older brothers who also worked for MI6. So, you know, somebody once asked me for details. And honestly, you know, if you have spies in the family, they never tell you anything.
Know,
that's the trouble. And my grandfather died in 1943. So that was sometime before I was born. You know, he died during the war. So we're still just learning a little bit about what that was all about, you know, but spies, you know, I mean, I think it's, there's a reason my mother took till she was 86 to tell me about the South Africa thing she did.
How did family respond having you? I mean, I know they're disguised as, you know, fictional characters, but how did they respond to having, your family history, you know, form the basis for your series?
Well, you know, in my family, descendants of my mother, there's only me and my brother left, and then our children. So my brother always thinks I glamorize our mother way too much. But other than that, he's 10 years older than me, and he was born in South Africa, and I thought he knew more of her relatives than I ever knew, because I was born here in Canada. And I would say, you know, did you ever meet our grandfather? No, he never did. He had no idea he was a spy. So, you know, that's what I mean. Even my much older brother never learned anything.
Now, your family is perhaps a little different because everyone loves a good spy story. But how do you find that sort of kernel in a family story that gives it a universal appeal that everyone would be interested in?
Well, I think it always goes back to the characters, doesn't it? I mean, I try to write really, really engaging characters. And, you know, the feedback I get from readers is that that's what my characters are. They're very engaging. So, you know, when I first started the books, it was really my mother herself as a person that inspired Lane Winslow. I never had this idea that Lane Winslow would go through her life doing things my mother did, because she was very different. In some ways, I wrote the ideal mother in Lane Winslow, really. But as I wrote along, I would realize that my mother did some spectacular things, and I decided I would incorporate them. And, you know, so that's been very interesting to be able to just think a little bit more about how, like, my mother was very, very resourceful and very, very brave. She was courageous beyond belief. You know, and there have been a couple of periods in her life when she was attacked or threatened, you know, once at knife point, once she was almost kidnapped. And, you know, the way she got out of these things was absolutely phenomenal. And so I decided to include that kind of a spirit in her. And I think anybody writing a book that's fictional can go back and look at their family and see what some of those family traits are, or even some of those events where their family member proved to be, you know, very spirited and very, very brave and resourceful, and include those things. Why not? It's a way of celebrating them.
Now, you mentioned MI6, so speaking of them, I was listening to a podcast, British Scandal, not too long ago, where they were talking about Kim Philby, you know, one of the most notorious British spies who was with MI6 while he was also spying for the Soviets. One thing I was surprised about, though, was how many women were involved in espionage. Was that common that women were, I mean, there were just as many female spies in that story as males, and I was surprised. So have you found that, I mean, was that common for women to be involved in espionage?
Well, it probably wasn't as common as for men, for sure. But there were a couple of things. In the First World War, when they began to use women, they found that people didn't expect women to do that kind of thing. So you know, women had quite a bit of freedom to move around and do espionage type things because nobody suspected them. And in the Second War, interestingly, Hitler really didn't, you know, he didn't create major roles for women. He had some women spies and so on and so forth. But, you know, his idea about what women should do was very, very different. So, you know, I think that element of surprise was still there in the Second World War, that women could get under the radar much more than men could, because men were expected to be in uniform and fighting. So if you've got a man wandering around not doing that, you've got a problem. And if he's in a uniform, he can hardly be a spy, if you see what I'm saying. Whereas a woman could get around a lot and do an awful lot. So I think they were very useful in that way. And here in Canada, I went to Toronto. There's a very famous historical house there where during the early part of the war, they trained a number of women in sort of commando techniques and so on to go into the European theater. And, you know, they were they were trained to kill and all that kind of stuff. So it definitely was a thing. And I think it's because they could get around and not be suspected quite as much as men.
Let's say sort of took advantage of being underestimated.
Exactly.
What are some other things about women, and you can't see my air quotes, I'm saying back then, that people might be surprised to know?
I think one of the things that people would be surprised to know, and I hear this quite often when I'm speaking to groups of people, that younger women, so I would say women under 40, tend to think that I've been accused of having lain be doing things that a woman couldn't have done in those days. She was too independent. She was too free. She was too this. She was too that. And I think women my age know who all these women are who came out of the war. They were, you know, they had done things that women hadn't done before. They were working men's jobs. They were in science. They were in doing all kind, you know, in code breaking and all of that. They were doing really important jobs. And so when they came out of the war, they weren't shrinking violets, you know. They were, by and large, expected to return to the sphere of the home. That didn't always work out, but they were much more immune to kind of being pushed around, I think. You know, I mean, you couldn't have pushed my mother or any of my aunts around at all. They were absolute Amazons. And, you know, they lived in a time when a woman couldn't get a loan for a car. In fact, I lived in a time when you couldn't get a loan for a car. I had to, in 1970s, I had to go ask my husband to co-sign a loan for me because the bank says you can't get any money without your husband. So that was just in the 70s, which isn't that long ago. I mean, it may be for many of your listeners, obviously, but and I think that this idea of women being really restricted is more something of the 1950s than the 1940s. I think women eventually were pushed back into the home, were discouraged from seeking careers. You know, I went to school in the 60s, and you know, the big thing was you'd like to be a nurse or a teacher. I think the women coming right out of the war were much more sturdy and stood up for themselves, in fact, a lot better than people ever expect.
Yeah, I guess if you can stand up to a Nazi who's trying to kidnap you, you can stand up to just about anything.
That's right, a bank manager telling you you can't get a loan.
Well, what's next for you and the very independent, spirited Lane Winslow?
Well, I'm just thinking about that right now, actually. I always enjoyed the books where she travels. In the fourth book, she traveled to England because Inspector Darling gets arrested for murder, a murder that he apparently committed during battle, during the war. So she has to go over there, and that's quite a fun book. And now this one, To Track a Traitor, she's over in England again, tracking down her sister. And then I've just finished the manuscript for one where she's at home in King's Cove in British Columbia. And I'm now thinking of, pushing her across the border, maybe having her go back to the States. I have one where she and Darling go and have a honeymoon in Tucson, which is quite a sweet little book too.
Well, where can people buy a copy of To Track a Traitor to read while they're waiting for Elaine's next adventure?
If you're lucky, your independent bookstore has it. If not, your big box bookstore might have it. And if not, you can certainly get it on Amazon. It's also available on Kindle. And I think very soon, almost simultaneously, the audio for it is going to come out. So that'll be at some point on Audible as well with all the rest of the books. But, you know, it's always nice to encourage your independent bookstore to have it. Somebody just came back from Chicago and they said they saw my books in a couple of independent stores. So,
oh, wonderful. And I'll actually also give a shout out to bookshop.org, because if folks can't get to an independent bookstore, they can order them online through bookshop.org and still help support indies. So.
Oh, that's great. I didn't know that. That's wonderful.
And where can readers connect with you to find out more about what's going on with you and your writing projects? And
sure. So my website is ionawishaw.ca or ionawishaw.com. And so it's ionawishaw.ca. We'll get you there every time, or .com, I believe, is also working. And there you can read about my books. You can see some blogs that I've written in the past, and you can also send me a note through there. And I always answer my notes.
Oh, wonderful. Well, that's all I have for today. Iona, thank you so much for joining me in the corner to chat about Lane and spies and brave women and your new book, To Track a Traitor.
Thank you so much for having me, Alexia. It was a great pleasure.
And thank you, listeners, for tuning in to another episode of The Cozy Corner with Alexia Gordon. My guest today was Iona Wishaw, author of To Track a Traitor, a Lane Winslow mystery. Until next time, goodbye.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Cozy Corner with Alexia Gordon. I'm Alexia Gordon, your host. Please support the podcast by leaving a 5-star rating or review on whatever platform you listen on. Follow the podcast on Instagram at podcast_cozy, on Facebook at The Cozy Corner Podcast, and the web at thecozycornerwithalexiagordon.com. Follow me at Alexia Gordon Author on Instagram, alexiagordon.writer on Facebook, and alexiagordon.net on the web. Support me on Patreon at patreon.com/authoralexiagordon. And until next time, thanks for listening.